welcome to Back to the Source. This is the first episode of a bi-monthly podcast, and what we're going to do each episode, we are going to take a film that's been adapted, and we're going to look at the film, look at the original source, compare and contrast, yeah, and see how we get on. You've heard another little voice there already. It's not just me on my own. I'm Tom, and this is...
I'm Michael Rogers.
Hello. And you might be sitting there thinking, what credentials have these guys got to judge films by...
Yeah, who are they?
Absolutely none.
You have studied film, so you know what film's all about.
Yeah, supposedly.
That's the IMDb argument anyway.
You shouldn't have said that, because then I could just pull stuff out of the bag and sound amazing. Now there's, like, pressure already. Cool. But no, not only that. So, yeah, I've studied film, and Mike, in a previous life, was an actor.
Yeah, precisely. So I know about acting.
Exactly.
Yeah. That's my IMDb argument. So there we go. All sorted.
We're done. But aside from that, we both read. We both watch a lot of films. So
yep.
We think we can handle this. We'll see.
I've read a few books as well. So that helps.
We're jumping in. First week, first episode. We're going to do a massive film.
Oh.
We are going to do Jurassic Park this week.
Jurassic Park is one of my favourite films of all time. And... one of my favourite books.
Good start. It's a good start.
Yeah, good start. So, yeah. I think I've seen this film so many times. I know it almost word for word, I think.
You know what? I watched it again for this. And, yeah, it's one of those ones that really sticks in your head. Like, I do like the film. I'm not as big a fan of it as you are. But I'm a big fan of the film. I've never read the book, though. So this is going to be a bit interesting. We'll have sort of a nice discussion about it. The first thing I've got to say, watching the film, right... because I just watched it and I didn't bother doing any research beforehand, just went into it. The first thing, I put it on in my laptop, I was lying in bed, and just the first title that came up, I just thought, you know what, I can't watch this on my laptop. I have to go and get it on a big screen, because it's just...
That's it.
It's a big film, you know?
Yeah, well, I happened to buy this yesterday on Blu-ray in preparation for this. I haven't watched it. I've got it on right now as we're doing this. So, looking at Dr. Alan Grant right this minute, looking at Brachiosaurus. So,
is he like on his knees at this point? Yeah, or is he not?
Oh no, he's just getting out of the car. He's taking his hat off and he's getting out.
Oh, he's loving birds.
They do move birds. My favourite line. I don't know why.
I've got a couple of lines I want to pull up later because there's some in there that I just think, maybe a bit too on the nose. Yeah. First of all, so really interesting. I found out about this last night. The film rights for this book were already being argued over before the novel had even been published.
I heard that. That's amazing, isn't it?
Yeah. So it went from the novel. I think the novel had already been written, but it had yet to go to publication, and there was already people bidding over it. I mean, because it's such a filmic idea.
Definitely.
You think about it.
The
other thing I found out was, do you know the original idea that it came from that spawned it?
I did read it somewhere. I can't remember what it is now. Go on.
Well, because originally Michael Crichton wrote the original novel. He was going to write a screenplay about dinosaurs. And the original film he came up for was an idea about a grad student that recreated a dinosaur in his lab.
Right.
So you go from this little weird science idea and you've grown that into this huge blockbuster of epic proportions.
Yeah, immense.
Which is another thing. First of all, this film definitely wins the award for the most subgenres ever.
Really?
Wikipedia describes it as an epic science fiction adventure thriller film.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, it does cover most of those bases.
Mm.
It does. Yeah.
It's a good catch-all film. When was the last time you watched this film?
Ooh, probably a couple of months ago. Mm. I do watch it every so often. It'll be one of those films if I'm sat about and really bored and I want to watch something. Or if I'm in a bad mood, that it always helps me if I'm in a bad mood, stick this on.
Okay.
And it'll cheer me up every time, guaranteed. it's a brilliant. I love it. I think the fact is I saw it when I was so young. I mean, when did the film come out? 94?
This is another thing I was going to say, right? Because in my head, I thought 96. I had that in my head. Or 94. It was released in 1993.
93?
Yeah. It's nearly 20 years old now.
Christ. Yeah, I would have been 7 when I saw this film.
Yeah, same.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure I saw it in the cinema, 7 years old. Wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. But I think that's what it is. It's because I saw it when I was a child. I've always got it's a special place in my heart. Mm. Do you know what I mean? Because it does capture your imagination. And when you're about 7 years old, you think dinosaurs are amazing. And seeing them on the screen as well, walking and running and breathing and all that sort of stuff. You just, well, no, you do. You're like, wow, that's amazing.
Yeah.
I think I was convinced they actually found dinosaurs at one point.
Well, I mean, I think in my memory, this is my first big event film that I went to see. Yeah. You know, it's almost like our generation's Avatar, because there was so much hype about the way it had been made and, you know, the computer effects in it. And really, after Jurassic Park, you rarely saw stop motion or anything like that being used. It really did change.
That's it. Well, yeah, it's all the computer graphics came in at that point. I mean, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's the first one that used so much computer graphics in a film.
Yeah, to this level, because I think the first film with a computer and a computer effect would have been Young Sherlock Holmes. But I think that was probably only a few years before Jack Arroyo.
Was the Abyss? Didn't they use it in the Abyss as well for the water?
They did. I know that's something. It's a big effect. Like there's a stained glass window that comes to life in Young Sherlock Holmes, and that's the first big effect. Which again, Spielberg was involved with that, and then I think in a very short space of time, it grew to be able to recreate whole scenes like this. But another little thing, watching it back, there's things in Jurassic Park that even now have been replaced by CGI, like the helicopter scene at the very beginning of the film when they're flying into Jurassic Park.
Oh yeah,
it's a real helicopter. Whereas now they would just CG that in. I would imagine.
even to the point where some of the dinosaurs are still marionettes. The T-Rex, when it's about 50% of the bit where he's tearing the cars apart, that is a big model, a big puppet, basically, doing all that. And seeing those scenes, they blend so well as well. You'd expect, where it's in its infancy, the special effects, that you'd see a big jump between marionette and computer generation, but you don't. It's just amazing.
No, that's another thing I noticed, actually. The special effects do actually hold up really well.
Oh, they do, yeah.
Because I'm not a big fan of computer effects. I prefer things to be practical, but I have to admit that 20 years on, the dinosaurs still look good.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Yeah, yeah.
Go on.
What were you going to say?
Apologies, we haven't quite worked out this yet.
No.
But yeah, aside from the CG, the plot, we should just give a very basic rundown of the plot. If you haven't seen Jurassic Park, if you've been...
Where have you been?
Well, I was thinking this. I need to ask some young people whether this is a big film for them, because it might be one that's just slid under the blanket a little bit.
Well, this is a funny thing. I asked my sister yesterday. I bought this yesterday, and I asked my sister, who's 10. Well, she's 10 today, actually. The birthday today. And I said, do you want to watch Jurassic Park with me? And she said, no, it's boring. And I almost got very angry, started throwing things at her. But she's a little girl. Maybe it's not for little girls. Maybe not. But that would be interesting to find out if
it's held up. If it's
if it's held up for the generation.
Because it's not one of those, it's not really celebrated in the way that other films are, you know.
No, but
maybe that will come in years.
But
anyway, yeah, basic, very quick rundown of the plot. So we've got is he a professor, or we've got Richard
Doctor.
Hammond. Dr. Richard Hammond decides to open...
Oh, no, Richard Hammond, no, he's not a doctor, no. He's just a wealthy man who's a bit eccentric and decides to build a amusement park or a zoo with prehistoric animals in it.
And then it all goes a bit tits up.
Well, that's to be expected. Chaos theory. But
so, yeah, basically he's getting he's got the lawyers on his back. They don't want to open the park unless they can get recommendations from two scientists. So they invite a group of scientists to the park to give it the official stamp. And then, yeah, there's a problem with the computer side of the park. Dinosaurs escape and all hell breaks loose. When you look at that, it doesn't feel very bookish. It feels like a big... big scale action adventure film. You wouldn't automatically think of that as a novel, but having read the book,
the book goes in a slightly different way. It's still got all your action parts to it, but I would say the first half of the book is very much science based, trying to explain how these dinosaurs were made and all that sort of thing. and going into the theories of why it wouldn't work in the first place. That's what Malcolm does the whole beginning of the book, is just say how much this isn't going to work, and he knows it's not going to work the whole way through.
Right.
And it doesn't, and then it all goes tits up, like you say.
Mm.
But it still has all those action-y bits in it.
So there are big action set pieces within the book, then?
Well, yeah. Funnily enough, the film takes away, doesn't use a lot of the action bits that are in the book.
Okay.
There are certain bits. There's certain bits. The whole where she has to go and turn the power on, where Dr. Sadler has to go in and turn the power back on, and the Velociraptor's in there and chase her around.
Okay.
That's all in there, yeah. But a lot of it is not there at all. Oh, and the Tyrannosaurus Rex tearing up the cars with the kids in it and everything, that's there.
Okay.
It's between where the Tyrannosaurus Rex attacks and the end is completely different and all over the place.
How does it differ? Because in the film, the narrative sort of splits, doesn't it? You have Alan Grant in the park with the kids trying to get back to the main camp. You have Ellie Sadler and Samuel L. Jackson's character trying to restore power within the park.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two sort of narratives going on at the same time.
Yeah.
Is that sort of similar in the book? Or...
Yeah, that's all there. What really is the difference is in the book, Grant and the kids are being chased by this T-Rex,
okay,
which doesn't really come across. I mean, once I read the book and then I watched the film again, I was like, hang on, they've missed out a whole lot. The T-Rex pretty much stalks them all the way back to the visitor center. And they're always just in front of the T-Rex. And they think they've got past it, and then suddenly it turns up. There's a whole section of the book to get to the visitor center quickly. They have to travel down what will be the River Rapids ride.
Mm.
So they get in this boat and, they get in the boat and are chased down river by the T-Rex, with
okay,
the T-Rex going under the water and coming back up and trying to get them. A bit similar to in the third Jurassic Park film, they've got the big Spinosaurus that's chasing them through the water, similar to that.
I was going to say that, yeah, because they mentioned that in the write-up of the film, that was a big piece in the book that was then reused in one of the later films.
Mm.
And at one stage, that was actually in the screenplay for the first Jurassic
Park. I've seen the concept art for it, but by the look of it, it would have cost a lot of money to get that sort of thing done.
As
they were just learning how to use the computer graphics as well, it would have been very difficult, I would have thought.
A step too far at that stage. Mm.
But the whole part of the book, you really feel for him, because they're like, they are trying to hide and think of ways to outdo this T-Rex that's following them.
Mm.
And also, this is the thing, they're going down this river, they've got the T-Rex on their tail, and along the banks of the river are a load of the Dilophosaurus, the spitting one.
So okay.
You know, they're fucked, they're completely fucked.
So we are swearing in this podcast then.
Oh, sorry.
No, it's good. Nothing wrong with it.
Tits already. It's tits. Can't swear word.
It's 12, mate. 12, mate.
I've just bumped this up to an 18.
But yeah, that's interesting because, like, that what you've described in the book, that sounds like it belongs in an action film.
It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
It's like a chase. But what you get in the film is Alan Grant, that journey with him and the kids, that becomes much more about him and as a character. Because he starts off very standoffish with the kids, doesn't want to be with them, but then he's put in a position where he has to deal with it, and he finishes the film having gone through a journey. So it's interesting that in the film, him getting back to the visitor centres becomes a character journey, whereas in the book it was much more action-y.
So yeah, it's all mixed up, because there's a line in the book that says, Dr. Alan Grant loves kids.
Right.
And and in the film it's like, I hate kids.
Yeah.
And he loves kids because kids love dinosaurs. Little kids love dinosaurs. And he talks about how they learn the names of dinosaurs before they learn most other things.
Mm.
And he really connects with them. I mean, when he first meets Tim, those two like connect straight away. And yeah, it's a bit weird that the film uses the fact that he doesn't like kids. That's the sort of thing I would have thought they would put in a book.
Yeah, exactly.
That character arc would more like go in a book, and that would more go in a film, I would have thought.
Yeah, it's an interesting switch, because when I first started looking at this, I would have thought, because I was trying to look at Jurassic Park and figure out, okay, well, where are the elements from this film that have come from a literary source? And to me, I would have thought it was the characterization, because they're all very well drawn. You know, you have the stereotypes, the archetypes, like Dr. Malcolm and Mal Doon, the gameskeeper, especially. Yeah. He's very, like, he's a type. He's not a character. Yeah. He's not really a three-dimensional character. But
more
then,
of an archetype, isn't he? Yeah.
Exactly. But then you have the people like Hammond and Grant that are very well drawn. They've got, you know, good backstories, and they've got journeys that they go on the film. But looking at it, it seems like that was added in the film adaptation. Would I be right in thinking that?
They have. In the books, I would say that they're very different characters, a lot of them. Hammond's completely, well, he's quite different.
Mm.
In the film, he's a jolly, eccentric sort of, oh, I love making dinosaurs. Oh,
yeah,
wonder,
yeah.
You know,
look at the fleas, mummy, look at the fleas.
Yeah, and you get from the film that he wants to make this park so that everyone can enjoy it and everyone will come and see it, and he just wants to make people happy.
Mm.
The books, you realise, I want to make some money off this. Yes, I want to make dinosaurs so people can see them, but I want to make money out of this.
Okay.
Do you know what I mean? And he is eccentric, but he's more of a grumpy eccentric. He doesn't like people. He doesn't like people who tell him that what he doesn't want to hear.
So he's much more of a businessman in the book, then.
There's part of what you see in the film is him in the books, but there's also this businessman part, which doesn't really come out in the film, I don't think.
Is the character of the lawyer, is he a big part in the book? And is he like that in the book? Because the lawyer, it seems to me, to represent that business side in the film. He's the one that just wants to make money.
No, this is the thing. Again, he is a businessman, but he wants to come and check this park. He wants to come and check the park safe.
Right.
He's heard a load of stories. And a big part of the book as well is that dinosaurs have escaped the island.
Okay.
That's the bit. You've got the first four or five chapters about... Actually, it's in the second film. You know, the beginning of the second film, there's the little girl on the beach. There's all the little compies.
Yeah.
The biter.
Yeah.
That's from the first book.
Ah.
That's from the book. Beginning of the book. No, I've gone too far. No, sorry. The first bit, you're in a doctor's surgery in, where is it, Costa Rica.
Okay.
And it's a quiet little rural doctor's surgery. Suddenly this bloody great helicopter comes in, all these men start running in, and a almost like a Men in Black sort of person, you know, sunglasses, black suit, is saying, fix this man up. And he's got lacerations all across his chest.
Right.
He's quivering. He's like, what's happened here? And he's like, oh, he's fallen under a machine or something. And the doctor's looking at him going, nah, this is a mauling. This is you can't get this sort of, these sort of cuts from a machine. There's no dirt in the wound.
Right.
This person's been mauled by something. Takes a load of pictures. The bloke dies. And then she's like, oh, well, at least I've got the pictures. They're all gone. So that's forgotten about.
Okay.
Then it goes to this little girl on the beach who is in Costa Rica again.
Mm.
And she's on a beach. She's run down. She sees this lizard come up to her about the size of a chicken. And it bites her. And she ends up having to go to hospital. She lives, but she describes this lizard. And this bloke goes, there's no such lizard. You've made this up. It's only
right.
She mentions that it's got three toes or something like that. And say, no, there's no lizard that's got anything like that. And then they find a part of this lizard, and then they start sending it off to all these people to try and figure out what this lizard is. They think they found a new species. And then it goes to, the specimen goes to Alan Grant, or it's about to go to Alan Grant. And then that's where the film kind of cuts in, where they, Hammond comes and gets him to come to the island.
So in the book, Alan Grant is going there for different reasons then. He's going to the park to find out.
He's still going for the same reasons he is in the film. But there's a whole four or five chapters of trying to figure out what this thing is that it's attacked this girl, and it's, you know, we know it's a dinosaur, but they don't. And
wow, so that's a big chunk to have left out then.
There's a huge part, yeah, and then through the book there's a whole thing about, well, dinosaurs have escaped, and the arrogance of everyone else saying, well, no, you know, the scientists saying, no, the dinosaurs couldn't survive if they got out, and they can't breed. And then the people who run the security saying, no, we've got it covered. There's nothing like that. There's a whole thing about, we can count the dinosaurs.
Okay.
Okay, right. Brilliant. So he does it every time. See? And if there was one missing, we would be informed. And it always looks for a certain amount of dinosaurs.
Hmm.
Then I think it's Malcolm says, well, bump the number up. So it was like 250 or something. And he said, bump up to 300. And then they realized there's about 50 more dinosaurs. So they have bred.
Okay, right.
They've escaped as well. So that's a whole thing. And near the end, there's a whole thing with the velociraptors. They find the nest of the velociraptors. Because they're supposed to have 8, but they've got about 36 or something like that.
Right.
And they've been escaping to the mainland. Well, they are about to. I think they stopped the boat that's got the velociraptors on. But that's the whole big part of it as well. Where in the film, I think they just find an egg and go, life finds a way.
Yeah, true. I mean, so it looks to me like that subplot was transferred to the sequel.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know, because there is a second book, which I haven't read yet.
True.
So I don't know if that's a part of it, but...
But yeah. I can see why they left that out of the film, because it would have slowed it down a lot. And at the moment, as it is, it's very pacey and it moves along at a good pace, you know, which is very Spielberg as well. You know, it's a ride film. It's A to B.
Yeah.
Get you there as quick as possible. But that's interesting, because the first Jurassic Park film must have been released before the second Jurassic Park book. I would have thought
if they, because they got the rights for that film straight away before it even been written.
So I imagine that second book was probably almost being written as a film. You know, it was almost like the novelization of a film that hasn't been made yet, because it must have been such a sure deal.
Yeah.
When the first one finished, that there would be another one.
Yeah. Well, Michael Crichton was involved in writing the script for this as well.
That's right. Yeah. Right up until the end, he was working on it. And then David Coep came in and did the final draft. And that's another thing. What they do really well in the film is there must be so much, as you said, science and exposition in that book. And in the film, that is condensed into 3 minutes at the most with that cartoon film in it.
Yeah, that cartoon bit, that's all there. Well, that's someone explaining it in the book. And then I think, you know, where they're sat around the table having dinner? Pretty much most of that is condensed down in that, and it's just the best bits, the little bits that you need to know, really.
That's another thing. That table scene where they're having lunch and they are, Dr. Malcolm brings up whether what they're doing should have been done, and there's this whole ethical discussion. That, to me, feels very booky. That you can look at that and think, yes, that came from a novel, because it's that classic scene of characters discussing problems that the reader is imagining, you know, and it's solving problems. But then that in the film is 5 minutes, and then they're back into the park, and they're back being chased by dinosaurs. As someone who's seen both, would you say that this is a good example of an adaptation?
It's an excellent, I would say it's the best example I could ever find, really.
Yeah.
Because it's kept a lot of... it's kept a lot of the spirit of it, and it's changed it where it needs to be changed.
Yeah.
As well. For instance, the children.
Right.
Have been changed. the kids in the, are the opposite ages in the book.
Okay.
So the girls are younger and the boys are older.
I've got a little bit of trivia about that. Do you know why they changed that?
I'm guessing, I haven't looked this up, but I'm guessing because Timmy in the book sorts out the computers at the end and leaves the girl to do nothing at all. All she does through the whole book, I tell you what, if it was in a film, it would drive me up the wall.
Right.
But all she does is scream the whole way through and complain.
Yeah.
And I could deal without that. But I'm guessing it's just so that she's not a loose end, really, or, you know, useless character. But go on, tell me.
Well, that was an interesting byproduct. But the only reason they changed that is because Spielberg wanted to work with that actor that played Timmy. And he knew that he was too young to have a younger sister that would make any sense in that film. So they just switched the ages because of that.
I assumed it was just to give her something to do because she did nothing.
Hey, well, she falls out of an air shaft, Mike. Come on, give her credit.
Yeah, okay, fair enough.
I've got to say, that is the shoddiest effect in the film as well. Do you know the bit I mean? After they've been in the kitchen and she's in a, you know, Die Hard style, they're crawling through the air vents. Yeah. She falls down and they used a stunt woman for that and used computers to replace Lex's face. That, you can look at that and know that's an effect and it looks awful.
I always, do you know what, when I was a kid, I always thought that bit looked a bit dodgy.
Yeah.
I couldn't figure out why until I found out.
It's, you know, it's verging on Double Dragon with Van Damme, where someone's just cut the guy out and posted him back in. I've got a couple of questions, right?
Go for it.
I'm hoping that you will be able to answer these having read the book, okay? Mm. Number one, Mike, why are dinosaurs so angry? Because I don't get this, okay? It just suddenly, watching this again, it seemed to make no sense to me. Because, yeah, they're carnivores and they're predators, but they're always flipping angry, especially the raptors, you know?
Yeah, they're just angry in the book.
They're just angry. Just
pretty much, they're angry, yeah.
Pissed off about being unextinct. second one, I've only got one more, right? But, you know the very first scene with Grant when he's in the desert?
Yeah.
And this, I can imagine this being answered in the book. Not like the last one, but he's watching his radar and they're looking at an X-ray of a raptor.
Yeah.
And there's this kid and the kid starts saying, I don't think that's very scary.
Right.
Where the hell has the kid come from?
I have not. Do you know what? That's not in the book either. Because, I mean, it's got the thing where he doesn't like computers and everything.
Yeah.
But that kid is not there at all.
It doesn't make any sense.
I don't know. They should all be college students.
Exactly.
And helping him. Who the fuck's brought a kid? Because him and Ellie haven't got one. So.
But it's just watching it. It's ridiculous. Because
maybe he wanders the desert. He's just looking for people to talk to.
I think it might be that. And also, all those students automatically side with the kid as well. This kid who's popped up from nowhere, they're all on his side and laughing at Dr. Grant, who can fire them at a moment's notice.
Yeah, good point. Yeah, he's stupid, isn't he? Look at that little brat.
Yeah. Chubby little fucker. Okay, one last thing. There's one line in this film, right? That I know doesn't come from the book, and it's really telling. It's I can't remember where it comes in the film, but basically someone turns to Alan Grant and says, you're out of a job, and he says, don't you mean extinct? You know the line?
Yeah, I know the one, yeah.
You know the story of where it comes from?
I do. Go on.
Go for it.
You can explain it, isn't it?
It's Steven Spielberg said that line to Phil Tippett. Now, Phil Tippett was originally hired to do the special effects for Jurassic Park, and he was going to do all the dinosaurs as stop motion. This was before they were even considering using computers. Mm. So Phil Tippett was on board Jurassic Park all the way through production, and he'd already started doing stop motion tests with the raptors, which you can actually see. They're on the DVDs for Jurassic
Park. Used them as animatics after a while, didn't they?
Exactly, and they're gorgeous. The way these raptors walk and the weight in them because they're stop motion is absolutely beautiful.
Yeah.
Phil Tippett was with Steven Spielberg the first time he saw a test run of a dinosaur being made with computers. Steven Spielberg turns to Phil Tippett and says, you're out of a job. And Phil Tippett replied, don't you mean extinct? Does that not seem just so cold-hearted to you?
It does seem a bit bitchy, doesn't it?
Yeah. But he was so right as well. Like, after that film, you know, these people, these special effect artisans are really struggling to find work now because it just changed the industry in a matter of
Do you know what he's doing now?
I really don't. Do you?
No, because, I mean, I was watching some special features on here, and it was a new one, and he was on there, and he had a big grizzly beard. He looked like he was homeless. He might be homeless.
Yeah.
But, I tell you what, the one thing that always bugged me about the film, and it bugged me when I was a kid as well, there's when the T-Rex attacks.
Yeah.
Alan Grant gets out of the car and goes, "Don't move. Their eyesight's based on movement."
Yeah.
I was like, how the fuck do you know that?
Yeah, how? Yeah.
And it's explained in the book. It is explained in the book.
Oh, is it?
Yeah, yeah. It's not that he knows that already, because I was thinking, how would anyone know that from Bones?
Yeah.
You couldn't tell that from Bones, could you? What happens is he does get out of the car and he's terrified and he can't move. And the T-Rex doesn't see him. And then he goes into a whole long bloody discussion in his head about how some animals do that or something. But yeah, I thought that always bugged me in the film. Always bugged me.
Well, I think because I've only watched this recently, and I do know what you mean. There are a lot of things like that. It's bad sort of science fiction where characters just seem to know things, but actually they're just supposing them. But in the film, I think how they try to explain that in that scene with the mystery kid that just wanders the desert, when he's like explaining to him about raptors, he says one line about it, and he says, "Oh, and you just think that their vision's based on movement, blah, blah, blah." And he references it because Alan Grant in the film, I don't know if he's like this in the book, but he's very much of the opinion that dinosaurs didn't go extinct, they evolved into birds.
He's a bit more skeptical. He knows that idea and he thinks it's an idea, but he did think most of them got extinct.
Yeah, yeah.
And some of them did turn into birds or what have you. But not that they all turned into birds. No. That'd be a bloody great bird.
But there are a couple of little bits like that with the spitter. What's the real name for that dinosaur?
Dilophosaurus.
Dilophosaurus. Like, I always wondered that. How do they know that that's how it attacked with the venom? And especially the fans. How could you find fossil evidence of that? You
know? I think that's just made up. That's in the book as well.
Yeah.
There's a thing about his mouth being full of bacteria, like a, what's it?
A Komodo dragon.
Yeah, that's the one. Mm. And that it had these, and they didn't know where, they tried to remove the glands that spit, but they didn't know where they were, and they ended up killing a couple.
wouldn't you think after they killed it, they'd go, "Oh, you know what, we could do an autopsy now and find out where these glands are."
They'd just like, throw it away.
Throw it away.
No good to me now.
But I mean, as I think, I was trying to find other films that you could compare this to as a film. And I think that the number one answer I came up with was Westworld, because it's a similar situation. It's a theme park, futuristic theme park that gets out of control and the rides start attacking the people. Mm. And I think it's a product of the time in which the film was made as well, because Westworld was made, I believe, 70s. It might have been late 60s. But that is very science fiction. The characters in it are all archetypes. There's no development with them. The main character is Yul Brynner, who's a robot. Whereas with Jurassic Park, you do have character development and proper, you know, driven narratives. So I think that you can look at those two and say, well, this one feels more like a literary adaptation.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
Just come up to the scene with a Triceratops on the telly.
Oh, are you?
Yeah, yeah. Do you know why it's a Triceratops?
Go on.
Well, in the book, it's a Stegosaurus that's ill.
Okay.
And that Stegosaurus was, I believe, it was Michael Crichton's favourite dinosaur. Triceratops is Steven Spielberg's favourite dinosaur, so he changed it.
So he's letting Crichton know who's boss then.
Yeah.
Because Grant does say that as well, doesn't he? He was always my favourite as a boy. Another thing about that, right? The dinosaur vets are there or whatever, and Ellie Sattler's like, "What's wrong with it?" And the vet's going, "Oh, you know, it's got whatever." And then he says, "Labored breathing." The next shot is Grant lying on his lungs, like, this will help, it's labored breathing.
You see, this is pretty much exactly the same in the book, this thing, except for it being a Stegosaurus. What always occurred to me is, why does she know more than the vet?
Yeah,
he's not
exactly.
Even a vet.
Does she have the same job in the books?
Yeah, what is it? I can't remember. It's something
paleo,
to
do with...
botany.
Botany, paleobotanist, that's it, yeah.
Something to do with plants, yeah.
Yeah, so what's she doing there?
Yeah, tagging along.
Yeah. Another thing I wanted to ask, is Samuel L. Jackson's character in the book?
Yes.
Is he as cool?
Down to the T, chain smoking. A lot of it, I'll tell you what, a lot of little things are in the book. Like the chain smoking of Samuel L. Jackson's character.
Okay.
Malcolm's character being all in black. That's in the book as well.
Yeah.
Weird little things like that.
Malcolm, he's really he's a rock and roll scientist, isn't he? He's like tip of my tongue. Do you know who I mean? Northern scientist, did wonders of the universe. Brian Cox, Professor Brian Cox.
Yeah, it's a little bit, because you know, I saw the film first before I read the book, and I'm reading the book, and it got to describing Malcolm. He's all in the black. I was like, yeah, I know. I don't need to read this. Then he said he was balding as well, and that really threw me off. I was like, oh, he's balding.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
I don't. He is a bit of a rock and roll scientist in the book, but he's not as cool and suave as he is in the film.
Yeah, he really comes on strong with Sadler, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Droplets, or the water drops on the hand and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah.
How did he get invited, though?
Who?
Malcolm. Because he's a mathematician.
He's a mathematician in chaos theory. What explains this more in the book? All these people had been hired before the park had even started construction,
right?
As consultants.
Okay.
So Malcolm was had to write a paper or whatever saying if this would be possible. Dr. Grant would have to write. He wrote a paper or something for them about what the dietary needs would be and all this sort of thing. And so that's why they brought them back, because
they'd already been involved. So they already knew about the park before they went there then?
Malcolm did. Grant and Sadler were left in the dark. Sort of, it was more of a, do you think this would be possible if we could do it? Not that we're trying to do it. Is it going to be possible? Weird one. There's a whole bit at the beginning with some government agency questioning Grant about the John Hammond,
right?
Has been so secretive about it. He's been buying these supercomputers that cost billions of dollars, and he's got three of them. They want to know why.
I've got to say this, and I don't know if this is going to offend you or not, but talking about it now and like hearing you talk about the book and looking at the film, it feels very similar to a Dan Brown adaptation.
Yeah, I suppose so. Yeah, I can see. Yeah.
Because the way you've described the book is like as a page turner, you know, really that's all the Da Vinci Code is. And it's something that takes a nice idea and then just, you know, runs with it. Doesn't bother looking at the actual fact or anything like that. Although the science in Jurassic Park is, for the most part, fairly cromulent. It takes this idea and it runs with it. It turns it into this speedy action film, you know?
For the most part, there is big chunks of it that is very science-based. Pretty much when they get there and someone has to explain all the science, you do switch off and try to read through it so you can get to the good bit.
Oh, dear.
Yeah, but it's very science-y-based right at the beginning.
Okay. So, let's move on to some more questions.
Oh, go on, then.
So, as someone that's read the book, what do you think the book does better than the film?
The book does better than the film. It's a difficult one. I mean, I don't know. It explores more. The film is more of an action-y sort of film, got all this action the whole time, which you have in the book, but you've got all this other sub, like I said, all the arrogance of all the people thinking that this is the best thing that's ever happened and nothing could go wrong. Having to break down all these people to make them say, yeah, we don't know what we're doing really, or we think we know what we're doing.
That
runs the whole way through it. And that's a lot more interesting.
So I tell you what we haven't mentioned at all so far is Nedry.
Nedry.
Is that the same case in the book? Because Nedry steals the dinosaur embryos and sets a virus on the computer so that the system shuts down at a certain time so he could get off the island with these embryos. Is that the same? Does the catastrophic crash have the same reason in the books, or is that different?
Yeah, it's exactly the same. But he's going to go to the docks, drop off the stuff and come back and turn everything back on. And he can do it that. Do you know what I mean? He's only supposed to be gone like 10 minutes or something.
Yeah.
But that doesn't happen. And so nothing gets put back the way it's supposed to. It's a bit more clear why he's doing it as well in the book. I think, I can't remember exactly now, but it's Hammond goads him or something and tells him he's rubbish. He could get a million of him, and he feels really
underappreciated.
And so Dodgson comes up and says, "I'll give you some money if you bring me what they've got." And he's like, "Oh, okay, fuck them. I'll do this."
Because in the film, he's all about money, really, isn't it? You know, quite an excitable character. And then there's that scene where there's like hints of some problems in the past between him and Hammond. Before he escapes the park, Hammond comes over and he's hassling him, and he's, you know, that line of, I don't judge people for their mistakes, but I do ask that they pay for them. And there's that sense that Nedry's in financial trouble, and that's what's motivating him to steal the Emeralds.
That's not at all, because he's associated with some university as well, Nedry.
He's more of a sort of, he's got more standing in the books.
He feels he's been wronged, so he thinks he should get what he's deserved.
Okay.
He deserves, really. Yeah.
That's a nice
thing. Most of the characters are like pretty spot on. I mean, Muldoon, pretty much the same in the book.
Muldoon is a really good character. Even though he is an architect, he's a really nice guy to hang out with.
I think it's really nice they describe him as the great white hunter from South Africa. And I was like, it gives him some more mysticism, you instantly think he knows what he's talking about. And like in the film, he's saying we should kill them all.
Yeah. And then, you know, when he says that, this guy knows what he's talking about.
Yeah.
The girls. but I can see why they change certain things like that. Because with Nedry, you automatically cut out a lot of exposition and subplot if you just say he's doing it for the money. And then you accept that and you run with it. And you can get that over and done with and move on to the chaos in the park. So, okay, what would you say the film does better than the book? And I would say, from what you've said, my answer would be Alan Grant.
Some of the characters, Alan Grant, much better. Hammond, to an extent, because he is more... You don't think he's just arrogant in the film.
Yeah.
In the book, you get this arrogant... He really thinks he's doing something special in the film.
Yeah, he does, yeah.
He's really gutted when it doesn't work. And
And it's bigger than just the money. He's gutted because he thought he was creating something really, really magical.
Spectacular. And
that definitely seems to be the case from what you've said, though. And I'll go back to saying it before, like the first thing I thought about that when I was thinking about this as a novel was how well drawn the characters are. But it seems like a lot of that has actually been added with the film. And Alan Grant and, as you said, Hammond, they're made almost more human in a way, and they have this journey and these sensitive sides to them.
Malcolm as well, that's another one. He's got the best dialogue in the book. Any bits of anything whenever he's talking, you just can't help reading all that. It's spellbinding. But in the film, he's just so charismatic and everything, you really feel for him. He does die at the end of the book.
Really?
Malcolm dies. Well, there's a couple of people who die. Hammond dies at the end of the book.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah, he dies at the end of the book. He's trying to get away and he slips and falls down an embankment and twists his ankle, breaks his ankle. And he can't get up.
They just have to leave him.
Yeah. And he's trying to get back up the thing and the kids are doing something on the PA system, and he's like, those damn fucking kids, I should have never told them to come here, I fucking hate those kids. And then all the compies come in and eat him.
Oh god. So what, and even then, at the end he's raging against his grandchildren.
Yeah, at the end he's just like, kids. But here you go, someone who lives is the lawyer,
because he's the first death, isn't he?
Yeah,
essentially. Aside from the prologue, he's
from what I can tell in the film, he's an amalgamation of like two characters: the lawyer character, as he stands, and there's a guy called Ed Regis,
right,
in the book, who is he's the PA man or publicist or something,
right?
Like.
Okay,
and he ends up, he's an executive of some description. I can't remember exactly. And he's basically lumbered with the kids. He's just told to look after the kids. And that's not his job. And he's very bitter about it. And he's the one who gets eaten. Well, it's not on the toilet. He's the one who leaves the kids in the car on their own when the T-Rex attacks. Yeah.
But the lawyer character lives through it.
Yeah, yeah. He lives all the way through it. Yeah.
How sad. How sad. Mm. The body count in the film isn't actually that high, is it?
I'm trying to think.
Well, you've got the chap at the end, at the very beginning, who gets pulled into the raptor cage by the angry dinosaur. You've got the lawyer.
Yeah.
You've got Nedry. I think I'm doing these pretty much in order.
Yeah, then, that's Nedry's the next one. Yeah.
Then would it be Jackson next?
Yeah, Jackson's next. But that's off screen. You don't
see
that.
See his arm, don't you, with the bag stuck between the fingers.
Yeah.
But
and then Muldoon.
Oh, and Muldoon, yeah. So what's that, five?
And he doesn't die in the book. He doesn't die.
And he lives as well.
He lives through, yeah. But he's got more of a hero's death in the film, isn't he?
Yeah, definitely.
Because he's there distracting so Ellie can get through.
But that totally suits the way he's drawn that death, because he's that archetypal hunter and he just accepts it. He's been bettered by the raptors.
Yeah.
Okay. I think I've got through my page of notes. Any other business?
Any other business? No, I don't think so. Well, at the film at the minute, I've got to the T-Rex just about to attack.
Oh, it's a good scene.
I've got a leg of lamb on top of the cars.
That's another bit, because it's a goat, isn't it? It's a goat that comes up and Lex starts complaining about them feeding the goat. And the lawyer just says, "What's the matter, kid? You never had lamb chops?"
Yeah.
It's a goat, you know? Yeah. But cool. I think we've covered that pretty nicely.
Yeah.
Well, there we go. That's our first episode of Back to the Source. It was good fun. I enjoyed that.
That's good fun, yeah.
I wonder if anybody has actually listened to this.
Yeah, well, maybe. Well, I'll give it two or three, and then I think they'll...
There'll be
millions.
Yeah, we're going for a Kevin Smith empire here. So come on, send us your money. If you have listened, if you've downloaded this, and if you've enjoyed it, or if you haven't enjoyed it, if you've got any comments or queries or requests for future episodes, give us an email. Our address is backtothesourcepodcast@gmail.com, and we'd really love to hear from you. We will be on Twitter very, very shortly, but if you keep an eye on our iTunes podcast list, we'll give all the information out for that next week. But other than that, I've enjoyed myself.
Me too.
And I think that's good enough.
Yeah.
Bye.
So, until next time.
Awesome.